It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Every summer, publishers flood the market with the latest crop of beach reads. Page turners in popsicle colors. Heavy on plot, light on everything else. Now, I like those books as much as the next person. But if you've got 3 hours of uninterrupted time and a beach blanket or an Adirondack chair with a view, why would you waste that on something forgettable? Lazy summer afternoons deserve big books. Books you can sink your teeth into. Sentences with so many subordinate clauses you have to start over halfway through. Yes, it's summertime. The living is easy, but the reading shouldn't be. So today, welcome to the TT Book Difficult Summer Reading Show. Stories about big books and the readers who've tackled them. And we'll start right here with everyone's favorite difficult novel, Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. Colleen Leahy and Makini Allwood are working their way through it. Slowly.
My first encounter with Wallace's work was in college.
This is Colleen Leahy.
I've signed up for a class that had Infinite Jest on the syllabus. All I knew about Infinite Jest was that it's like, oh, it's like this huge book and it's genius. And like, if you want to be a well-read person, you read this book. And I was like, okay, I want to be a well-read person. There are so many sentences and places where I'm like, God,
all right. I don't even know.
Why?
Why?
It was just like, oh my God, like, do I even know English? I only lasted 2 weeks.
So that went well. But not totally unexpected. Infinite Jest is not a book you tackle lightly. But Colleen doesn't like to give up. So a few years later, she came back to it. And this time, she enlisted a friend, and they decided to make a podcast.
My introduction into Infinite Jest actually came through Colleen.
This is Makini Allwood.
When Colleen came to me, it was like, oh yeah, like, I think it's time to read the ultimate white male genius novel, Infinite Jest.
Yeah. She wasn't totally unwitting.
Strike this whole 600 pages.
What is even going on?
It took me 2 hours to read the first 15 pages.
Listen, I know what a book is. You know what a book is. Everyone knows what a book is. F that.
That's Colleen Leahy and Makini Allwood. Now, there was a time when our executive producer, Steve Paulson, met his own literary Waterloo, Jorge Luis Borges, the world-famous Argentinian writer and master of metafiction. You don't need endurance to read Borges. You need sanity. His short stories are labyrinths of unreality. And at 23, Steve Paulson was lost in them. And then he was sent to interview the man himself.
The year was 1983. I was just out of grad school trying to break in as a radio reporter when I got the call that Borges had agreed to do the interview with me the next morning. He was in town to give a big lecture and had some extra time at his hotel. Now, I should say that I was not remotely ready to do this interview. I'd read a few of his stories, and that's about all the preparation I'd done. I knew I was in over my head. The next day, I was greeted at the door by a beautiful woman, Maria Kodama, who later married Borges shortly before his death. By this time, Jorge Luis Borges was an old man, quite frail, but he had a regal air about him and was clearly aware that visitors were prepared to sit at his feet to soak in whatever literary magic he had to offer.
I would like to tell you that I never look for a subject. I let subjects find me. And then I write the way they want to be written. I try to meddle as little as I can with my own work. Especially, I don't want my opinions to intrude in what I write. And of course, I have many opinions. Well, after, well, when one is 84, one is chock full of opinions and prejudices, so I try to keep them out of my work.
I have to say, I was entranced by this vision of writing, but I had no idea what he was talking about. What did he mean he didn't want to meddle in his own stories? Isn't meddling precisely what writers do? Or did Borges have some special pipeline to the muses?
Well, I have a certain kind of dream given me. In the case of a tale, I'm always given the beginning and the end. And then I have to invent what happens in between. Then I have to find out whether that particular tale, well, should be staged at the end of the 19th century or in some dim Orient. That's up to me. But I'm always given something. I never look for subjects.
Now, I should mention that Borges had been blind for nearly 30 years by the time I met him. He'd long since stopped writing those mind-bending metaphysical fables that had made him famous. I later learned that he tried reading by Braille, but then lost the feeling in his fingers. Most of his work since the late 50s consisted of giving lectures and dictating poems. But he'd also been named director of the National Library in Buenos Aires, a library with nearly a million books. It was an odd job to give a blind man, but somehow perfect for Borges, with his encyclopedic knowledge of literature and philosophy, his nearly mythic powers of memory, and above all, his love of books.
The universe, which others call the library, is composed of an indefinite and perhaps infinite number of hexagonal galleries, with vast air shafts between, surrounded by very low railings.
That's the opening sentence to a story called The Library of Babel. I have to say, I've never forgotten that image of a great library as a universe unto itself.
We also know of a superstition of that time, that of the man of the book. On some shelf, in some hexagon, men reasoned, there must exist a book which is the formula and perfect compendium of all the rest. Some librarian has gone through it, and he is analogous to a god. In the language of this zone, vestiges of this remote functionary's cult still persist. Many wandered in search of him. I pray to the unknown gods that a man, just one, even though it were thousands of years ago, may have examined and read it.
The American writer David Foster Wallace has called Borges a mystic, or at least a sort of radical Neoplatonist, for whom human thought, behavior, and history are all the product of one big mind. You can see this idea popping up in some of his stories, with the hero desperately trying to find the one perfect book that would capture the wisdom of all books. Of course, it's a hopeless quest, but one that demanded a lifetime of reading. Borges thought a good writer is by definition a great reader, and reading, perhaps even more than writing, is the highest calling.
My real destiny is to be a man of letters. Perhaps not a good writer, but a good reader, at least. I think I am a good reader, and in many languages.
For Borges, there's no clear dichotomy between fiction and nonfiction. Some of his most famous stories read like mock scholarly essays. The implicit message is it's impossible to say anything original. But there are all kinds of wonders to be found by reinterpreting what's already been written. Take one of his most famous stories, Pierre Menard, author of The Quixote. It's the tale of a man who rewrites the great novel by Cervantes.
He did not want to compose another Quixote, which is easy, but the Quixote itself. Needless to say, he never contemplated a mechanical transcription of the original. He did not propose to copy it. His admirable intention was to produce a few pages which would coincide word for word and line for line with those of Miguel de Cervantes.
So Pierre Menard doesn't change a word as he rewrites Don Quixote. I mean, not a single word. But he agonizes over the writing because he's a 20th century man steeped in Nietzsche and Bertrand Russell who's compelled to write a 17th century novel. To do this, Menard has to rediscover the Catholic faith and forget modern history. And how does Menard's Quixote compare to the original? Well, here's the kicker. Even though they're identical, Borges tells us Menard's version is almost infinitely richer.
It is a revelation to compare Menard's Don Quixote with Cervantes. The latter, for example, wrote, Part 1, Chapter 9, "Truth, whose mother is history, rival of time, depository of deeds, witness of the past, exemplar and advisor to the present, and the future's counselor. written in the 17th century, written by the lay genius Cervantes, this enumeration is a mere rhetorical praise of history. Menard, on the other hand, writes, "Truth, whose mother is history, rival of time, depository of deeds, witness of the past, exemplar and advisor to the present and the future's counselor." History, the mother of truth. The idea is astounding. Menard, a contemporary of William James, does not define history as an inquiry into reality, but as its origin. Historical truth, for him, is not what has happened. It is what we judge to have happened.
So what should we make of this strange metafictional world where all books refer to other books? It's tempting to say it's nothing but a game, and certainly this is one writer who loved to play with his readers. To me, Borges is a philosopher dressed up as a short story writer. He once said he never wrote a novel because he didn't have that much to say, but the truth is he was temperamentally suited to a more condensed style of writing, where one idea, for instance, rewriting the Quixote without changing a word, could itself be the plot.
Besides, I think a novel stands for padding. Even in the case of Dickens or Joseph Conrad, who was the novelist, while a short story can be essential. If you take the story by Rudyard Kipling, for example, I think every word is really needed.
In the last decades of his life, Borges had become a larger-than-life figure who was expected to dispense wisdom from on high. I went to see his public lecture the night after I interviewed him and was disheartened to hear him use the same language, even some of the same phrases that he'd used with me, like the bit about always being given the beginning and end of a story and having to invent the middle. But then Borges had long since realized that literary fame was just another kind of racket. In fact, he'd already commented on his own celebrity in his wonderful essay, Borges and I.
The other one, the one called Borges, is the one things happen to. I walk through the streets of Buenos Aires and stop for a moment, perhaps mechanically now, to look at the arch of an entrance hall and the grillwork on the gate. I know of Borges from the mail and see his name on a list of professors or in a biographical dictionary. I like hourglasses, maps, 18th-century topography, the taste of coffee, and the prose of Stevenson. He shares these preferences, but in a vain way that turns them into the attributes of an actor. It would be an exaggeration to say that ours is a hostile relationship. I live, let myself go on living, so that Borges may contrive his literature. And this literature justifies me. Years ago, I tried to free myself from him and went from the mythologies of the suburbs to the games with time and infinity. But those games belong to Borges now, and I shall have to imagine other things. Thus, my life is a flight, and I lose everything. And everything belongs to oblivion. Or to him. I do not know which of us has written this page.
During our interview, Borges joked about his own death. He said most of his friends were now pushing up daisies. He died 3 years later. Over the years, I've wished I could go back to 1983 and talk to him again, this time around having read all his stories and essays and the major critical studies of his work. I'd ask Borges why he was so fond of nearly forgotten British writers like Chesterton and Stevenson, and what he thought of the writers who followed in his footsteps, about García Márquez's experiments with magic realism, about David Foster Wallace's own obsession with footnotes. I'd also press him on his failure to write anything more substantial, or at least longer than 20 pages. Did he really value brevity so much, or was he simply incapable of creating a more involved fictional world? Now, I might add, if I were a character in a Borges story, I might very well go back and interview him, and wouldn't that be something, an interview with a dead man, or maybe with the benefit of time travel and a brain implant, morphing the mind of a middle-aged radio producer into his 23-year-old former self. Now, that would be a story I'd want to read. Somehow, I think Borges might approve.
That's Steve Paulson talking with writer Jorge Luis Borges. So we talk with a lot of writers on this show, and we're always curious about what books made the biggest impact on them. The answers can be pretty surprising. Like, I would not have guessed Turkish writer and Nobel laureate Orhan Pamuk's favorite novel.
If you ask me what is the greatest novel ever written, I think it's Anna Karenina. I strongly think that it's a miracle of a novel. Every word of it is miraculously beautiful. I am teaching it at Columbia University to my students. And I always wonder, what's the balance? The book is full of enjoyment of life, its peculiar aspects, little details of life captured with such full force and vitality and convincing crisp quality. And also it's about dramas of human beings, extreme compassion paid even to the little figures or most guilty ones, the writer's desire to produce a whole, the intermingling of the themes, and it's a book of various couple stories followed in comparison. It is also a comparative couples or love stories or marriage stories. And one of the most important things that I always keep in mind, it is about what is important in life, and novels should be about what is important in life. That is love, marriage, friendship, struggle, making money, community, family, history, belonging. Novels should be about that, and Anna Karenina is essentially a glorious, wonderful novel about these issues that takes place in Moscow and St. Petersburg in 1870s. The first sentence is astounding. It's almost people's wisdom in the streets of Russia. All happy families are alike, but all unhappy families are different in their unhappiness, is one of the most memorable openings of a novel. And I read first that in Turkish in 1971. I was 19. I had a picture of him by Repin on my wall 2-3 years later, when I first began to write my first book. Emulate is not a word, but I continue to admire him. You don't have to write much, but you have to write one good book or two good books will save your life.
Orhan Pamuk has written more than 20 books, and he's a Nobel laureate. If you want to hear our full conversation with him, it's online at ttbook.org, where you can also find the TT Book Difficult Summer Beach Reads list. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about the pleasures of deep reading, something I think a lot of us are finding increasingly hard to do. Like, I've noticed that when I sit down with a book, the first thing I do is check my phone. 45 minutes later, I've read the headlines, email, Facebook, and a whole bunch of articles that friends sent, but I still haven't opened the book. Well, Marianne Wolfe is one of the world's leading experts on the neuroscience of reading, and she says reading online like that is actually rewiring our brains. And she warns that we are not only changing how we read, but how we think.
And here's where I think it's really most threatening, if you will. It will actually change what is written ultimately.
So have you had this experience, like picked up a book you think you should love or want to love or did once love and just couldn't get into it?
This is a rather sad awakening to me. Last year, I decided, because I'm writing a new book on the reading brain, whether or not I had changed along with everyone else. But to test this like a scientist, I had myself pull out a very complex but beautiful book I once loved. And it was Magister Ludi, or The Glass Bead Game by Hermann Hesse. Yes, and I used to love this book.
But it is kind of a dense book, and it is,
it is
500 pages long or something.
But I wanted to test myself because density is one of the things that we're losing. So the test was to choose a dense book whose plot I knew, and so I could really focus and immerse myself in it.
And did it have the same old magic?
Oh, it was just the worst possible experience a reading researcher can have. It was like molasses on the brain. I hated the book. I didn't want to go past the first chapter. I thought, why in the world has Hermann Hesse ever won a Nobel Prize for literature? And it was really one of the great wake-up calls in the last 2 years for me. And I realized I could not slow myself down, that I was attempting to, in fact, invoke the same reading style that I was using the rest of the day. It made the very experience of reading onerous and distasteful. I was so frustrated, I just practically thrust the book back and thought, that's it. And then I felt great remorse. Because all of these books, all of them, are the stuff from which our lives have been made, the insights that have made us who we are. So out of pure guilt, I took the book back the next day and I forced myself to read just 20 minutes a day. And basically, it took me 2 weeks before I returned to what Klinkenborg said, the reader we've been.
Wait, did you get it back? Did you get to the point where it was delicious to curl back up with that book?
Oh, it was so much as if I had come back to my cerebral home in reading. And it was so good that I actually then allowed myself almost the luxury of reading it now for pure pleasure. And I read it a second time.
Hmm. I want to push back for just a minute because it's possible, of course, that literary taste is just changing, as it always has, you know?
And will.
In the 20th century, people wrote different kinds of novels than they did in the 18th century, thank goodness. Mm. Maybe we're not becoming worse readers. Maybe in some ways we're becoming more demanding readers. We want cleaner, clearer, crisper writing than, you know, Henry James or Hermann Hesse.
It's a very thoughtful and pithy question, but I would find it a great impoverishment if the young of our next generation would have only a diet of the simplest of sentences, which would never properly represent the natural convolutions of complex thought. And so when I hear chairs of English departments lamenting that their students no longer want to take Henry James, just as you suggested, no longer want to read the sentences of George Eliot or Marcel Proust, that gives me an absolute fear that we will not have a generation who understands the richness that's possible in literature.
But I think it's what you're saying, right, is that it's not just whether or not we love and appreciate rich literature. I think what you're suggesting is that how we read is how we think. And that if we lose the ability to read and take pleasure in those deep, complex sentences, or maybe novels with multiple subplots and 100 characters, if we lose the ability to do that, we're not able to think in as complex a way. Is that right?
It's also not developing the ability to appreciate the great richness in words themselves. That will be lost if we have a skimming, browsing, word-spotting way of reading. The brain is very, very plastic. It will reflect how we read.
Why would it matter so much what we're reading? We're still talking about words in print. Why does it matter whether the words in print are on a physical page or on a screen?
I think there are important advantages and disadvantages to both mediums. So I'd want to be sure that the real equation is not either or, but how do we enhance the experience of reading for the young by giving them what I will call a biliterate reading brain, when to use which mode for what material under what circumstances and purposes.
Well, wait, now, what's the difference? Like, yes. What's good digital reading versus what's good print reading?
So in print reading, we know a great deal about what makes a great expert reader. And part of that is time to process, time to take on the perspective of others. Now, with digital reading, there is both the reality and a quasi-illusion that all you have to do is press another button, if you will, and you will have access to all kinds of information instead of having your own. So I would love to have the sense that our young are learning how to slow themselves down and not depend on another click and learn not to be so easily distracted that they become what people like Seymour Papert and Howard Gardner call grasshopper minds. We have to fight this peripatetic mind that many of our children have. They are hyper readers. We have to almost rein in their natural desire to go to the next stimulus, to teach them those focused reading skills that print reading really fosters very nicely.
I guess I'm curious, what does this mean, say, for students today who have to balance doing focused reading for school and with their constant online digital consumption, you know, their texting and even research they may have to do for school?
There are two things that are happening at the same time, or even three, that really make almost a perfect storm for our students. The glut of information, the amount of distractions, and their absolute recognition that they can't possibly consolidate all of this in their memory. And so they are using other people's thoughts more than their own. All this information has a good aspect and a bad, but it's fragmenting rather than helping them become more logical thinkers. So my hope is that we can really make people aware of this fragmentation of attention so that they will learn how to focus more and enjoy being immersed instead of moving from one stimulus or one device to another.
Marianne Wolfe is a child development professor at Tufts University, and she's the author of Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. Sometimes what makes a book hard to read isn't the content, but the actual physical book itself. A few years ago, an unforgettable book arrived here in the mail. It's 14 by 20. Weighs more than 20 pounds. It's beautifully illustrated and written in calligraphy in a language nobody understands. Is it a real language? Is it a code? Nobody knows. The book is Codex Serafinianus. The author is listed as Luigi Serafini, but no one seems to know much about him either. Charles Monroe Kane loves a puzzle. So he got hold of the book's publisher, Rizzoli's Charles Meyer, to get to the bottom of the mystery.
Can you, and this probably be the hardest thing you'll do all day, can you describe this book?
That is the hardest thing I'll do all day. You know, it's a fantasy with illustrations and calligraphy following the structure of an atlas or a travel book from the 17th or 18th century, I would say, some reference to illuminated manuscripts. And it's difficult to interpret, but wonderful to experience. And it bounces, I guess, between sort of references to a distant past and explorations of a distant future. How's that for a mouthful?
That was a big mouthful. I think there's a couple words that I don't think need to go in there. One, it is surreal. I mean, if you want to define surreal, boom, this is it. Can you pick a page for me that you really like? Because once you describe a page, you'll be like, oh, it is quite bizarre.
Well, I think that one of the signature pages, but there are so many, but one of the signature pages is of a series of illustrations of a couple making love, and they gradually morph into the shape of a single alligator. And then as the drawings go on, the alligator slowly, one imagines, gets off the bed and disappears, leaving just this blank bed. And that's the kind of wonderful metamorphosis that you experience in every page.
My favorite page, and of course I can't give the page number because we also failed to mention that the language in this and the calligraphy written is made up, or presumably made up. It could be by an angel or an alien. We can talk about that later, but it's made up, and it's kind of three people, human-looking people, mushroom-head people with spurs on their boots, and there's a bunch of skeletons waiting in line, and on one end, there's some dead bodies, the skin's being taken off, the skeletons are waiting in line to get the skin put back on them. And then there's a bunch of writing around it in this made-up language. And then, of course, the skeletons are lying on a bed of books. I don't even know where to start with that. It's actually fantastic.
It is indeed. I mean, there are all kinds of wonderful things that one brings from one's own visual encyclopedia. You know, is it gory, Edward Gorey? Is it steampunk?
Right.
To go back to the word surreal you used, when Serafini was first working in Rome in the 60s and 70s. This was a time when Fellini was still very active, and they were friends. De Chirico was still alive, you know, the great surrealist, Italian surrealist artists and filmmakers and so forth were all still about, and I think he was very influenced by the mood in Rome at the time.
You know, for me, I lived in Prague for many years and had a couple of friends who were really into alchemy. And there's an alchemy museum in Prague, quite a real one, quite serious. And they had a alchemy book exhibit once that we went to. And the original of the Codex was there. And it blew my mind. And these guys were convinced, my friend at the time, I didn't know any better, that this was connected to the Aleppo Codex, the Codex for the New Testament, and that this was one that was written in a secret language that actually maintained the real truth of God and something they wanted to get their hands on, and they wanted to break in and actually read it. It was really interesting stuff, which gets into my next question. People put a lot of meaning. I went on the internet searching around for this book. Oh my God, there's some really weird websites and blog settings for this book. Why do you think people put so much meaning into it? What are some of the things people are talking about with it?
What are people talking about now? There's a lot of blogging about this. People are still trying to decode it. There's been a rich literature on the pagination.
Code 21 or something?
Code 21, right. Yes. I've not been able to unlock that or even
<Me neither.
laughs> really try to. But the folios, apparently, if you understand codes, working formulas of the number 21. I think people are, first of all, thrilled to see it back and available, and that sparked a whole new dialogue about it. And many, many people that I've seen are talking about how they've been trying to figure it out for 20 years, unsuccessfully, I might add.
Well, you know, it goes back to the alchemist, right? Maybe, you know, salvation is in the journey, right? So maybe they spent 20 years trying to figure out that is the point.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point. And I think the process of that is very much Serafini's point.
Now, this has been translated. There was a linguist in Bulgaria who I think was a contemporary when I lived in that part of the world who translated this, right? Or thinks he translated it.
I thinks he translated it, I think, would be the right thing. I mean, the calligraphy is, there are different words that have been used. It's a semic. Or it's a conlang. I always think of it as automatic writing,
right.
Which is something the surrealists use. But it's played very effectively now, too, because I think there's a resonance with a lot of graffiti and street art where people do make up their own languages and their own signs, and I think that's something very contemporary.
We should keep in mind that this wasn't written in the 1300s. This was written in the 70s. You know the author. He's done other books. He does children's books. What does he say of all this, about his codex?
He's appropriately sort of built a mystique around
it. Yeah, good man, good man.
he has said a few things. His comments on the writing basically center on the fact that he thinks it's a liberating experience, that you can't understand the writing itself, and he's denied that it has any real meaning. I think that what he really means by that is that when you do look at an old book or you do look at the codex, you often don't understand what is being said. It's in another language or it's in Latin. It's in a typescript that's very hard to read. And what it encourages you to do is to roam, to use your eyes, to really try to experience the visual sensations of the work.
Now, of course, with your beautiful edition that's out, Serafini was asked, it must have been by you probably, to make a statement on this book. It's pretty short. It's about 2 pages. And in the end, he says that he didn't write it, and he felt like maybe he shouldn't even deserve the copyright privileges because his cat wrote it. What do you think of the cat? Tell me more about what he meant there.
I think it's wonderful. He thinks, after thinking about why the book became, that it was the result of the cat's dreams, and he ciphered them onto the page. What I love about that is the cat was apparently perched on his shoulders or fell asleep on his shoulders while he was working. And if the tail wagged to the left, then it would result in a folk tale that he would draw, and to the right, a song. And I just thought that was so poetic and wonderful. And who couldn't fall in love with him, with the book, and indeed with the cat?
Charles Meyer, the publisher of Rizzoli Press, talking with Charles Monroe Kane about the Codex Serafinianus, a book which has spun off college courses, linguistic debates, talk of a cult, and a few tattoo designs. Want to see a few pages? We've got them at ttbook.org. So what's next on the TT Book Difficult Summer Beach Reads list?
My name is Emily Parker, and I'm the author of Now I Know Who My Comrades Are, Voices from the Internet Underground. The book that I would like to recommend is called Conversation in the Cathedral. It's by Mario Vargas Llosa, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature. I think that Conversation in the Cathedral is a book that maybe less people have read. It's a long book, it's a complicated book, and it's a difficult book. But I think it is one of the best examples of how a novel can describe life under a dictatorship. And so what Vargas Llosa does in this book is he just describes how dictatorships influence every aspect of life, and political repression influences every aspect of life. It can be relationships between friends, it can be in relationships between fathers and sons, it can just be the general ambiance at a bar. And he really just creates this atmosphere of what it feels like to live in a world where you don't feel free. And I think this book is important because there's so much written about repressive governments and about freedom, and a lot of this is written in the form of articles or nonfiction, but sometimes fiction can uniquely capture the atmosphere of life in this kind of political environment. I'm very proud to say that Vargas Llosa actually read my book and wrote an article about it, and which was the most exciting thing that has ever happened because he's really one of my favorite authors. Vargas Llosa is a very renowned novelist. He's written both fiction and nonfiction. One of his main causes in life is writing about the struggle for freedom. And I think that he has realized and he has expressed that sometimes fiction is the most powerful way to describe this phenomenon. Another one of his books is called The Feast of the Goat, which is about the Dominican Republic. In that book as well, he really describes the life of people who are sort of deprived of basic freedoms. And I think Vargas Llosa's work is really important because we often talk about political repression in very abstract terms. And I think when you're reading a newspaper article, sometimes it's hard to really understand how these political systems affect average people. And Vargas Llosa's novels do that brilliantly. I started reading him a few years ago, and I think I started with Conversation in the Cathedral, which, again, is a very difficult book. You kind of read it, and it's very hard at first to understand what's going on, and it's very confusing. I felt that I was pulled into this dark world, and you feel almost uneasy reading, and you feel almost sick reading it, like you're kind of living in this unhealthy environment. And I just remember thinking, wow, this is a really powerful novel.
Emily Parker recommends Conversation in the Cathedral by Mario Vargas Llosa. You'll find more bookmarks and an interview with Parker on our website. That's at ttbook.org. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
I'm Juno Diaz, and I'm a writer, and the book that I want to talk about, the book I kind of want to gush about, is Samuel R. Delaney's novel, Dark Reflections. Samuel R. Delaney writes novels. He's a memoirist, has written comic books. His novel, Dark Reflections, is this beautiful exploration of the life of a closeted African-American poet living in New York. Arnold Hawley, I think is his name. The novel starts out with Arnold already being, if I remember correctly, in his 60s. He's kind of eking by, hoping to get his poems published, hoping to win competitions, and he's never really confronted the facts of his sexual orientation. He's never really dealt with his desires. He's been really closeted. And so we see him struggling to be an artist in a place that doesn't care about poetry, but at the same time struggling with himself. And it is a novel that is structurally fascinating because it starts out when he's this, you know, 50-year-old man still having hope, but really kind of squandered his life, I would argue. And then the novel goes back in time, so that by the end of the novel, we see him at his most youthful, powerful self at the start of his career, at the start of his life, and it's kind of heartbreaking that way. It is a luminous novel. Delaney can be very experimental, but this novel is the novel that I always say is the gateway drug to Delaney. An extraordinary character portrait of a man in a time and a culture that doesn't have much room for the arts, a culture which I think we would recognize. And at the end, one of the things that I'm left with this novel is not only the extraordinary command and literary gifts that Delaney has, but I'm left with what I always seek in a piece of literature, to feel that I have been in communion with another human soul for the duration of the novel. And that's something that Delaney renders most magnificently, as he renders the soul of his protagonist, Arnold. And it's one of those things that we, of course, need. We need that kind of contact with other people, and this book delivers it.
Novelist Juno Diaz on Dark Reflections by Samuel R. Delaney. Intrigued? Listen to our interviews with Diaz and with Delaney online at ttbook.org. This hour, we're bringing you alternative summer beach books. And there's one we absolutely can't forget. So, picture yourself at the ocean. The smell of sunscreen, the sound of waves, and a great white whale. Moby Dick. Not what you had in mind when you packed the cooler, I know. But Ricardo Pitts Wiley is here to make the case for Melville's masterpiece. He's the co-founder of the Mixed Magic Theater Company and the writer and director of their theatrical production of Moby Dick, Then and Now, a production from Rhode Island's State Juvenile Correction Facility.
And I was the one who chose Moby Dick as the project. And as a matter of fact, there was quite a bit of questions when I suggested it, because I had an idea going into the program that I could relate the Moby Dick story to the drug trade. And there was a lot of concern about that going in. But I believed in the idea. And once I got in there with the students, they not only confirmed what I believed about the power of the novel and its flexibility and pliability, but they also freed me and my imagination to explore the novel at a much deeper level than I had originally thought I'd be able to do.
How does Moby Dick relate to the international drug trade?
Well, if you look at the basis of the novel, Ahab was in the business of killing whales. He wasn't a casual bystander in this business. So when he was attacked by the whale was in his turf, in his territory. And, you know, Ahab wasn't on the QE2 on vacation. He was trying to kill whales. It's ultimately about the money, what we are willing to do for the money. You venture into this world where you're after something that's so big and so powerful that you really don't always understand how big or powerful it is.
Are you saying that instead of a novel about the great white whale, you can see it as a novel about the great white blow?
Most definitely. In my production, we call what the young people are dealing with white thing. Part of what I had to do in constructing my play was the crew, the gang, if you will, I call them the crew of young people who pursue their white whale, which is called white thing, the drug lord. They've been wounded by this thing also.
So how did these young incarcerated men respond when you first pitched the idea of working with Moby Dick to them?
They embraced it much easier and quicker than I thought they would.
Had any of them even read Moby Dick?
Most of them read it. And if they hadn't read it when we started, by the time we ended, they had all read it. And they became very invested in the work. Because one of the things that I had asked them to do was take a character out of Moby Dick and rethink it the way in your life and time. Think about a character as you would create that character. And that probably was the most significant part of the experience, because for as much as I had an idea about how I could tell this story in a modern context, they took it further than I would have originally.
What kind of stories did they come up with?
I'll use the young man who chose Queequeg as his character. He said, well, Queequeg is a pimp. A pimp? You know, when you first meet him, he's dealing in human flesh. He's selling shrunken heads in New Bedford. He's exotic. He's beautiful. He's dangerous. He's intensely loyal. And he is a person you would want as a friend and do not want as an enemy. Another young man wrote about Ahab, and he said, well, you know, Ahab's in the business. He was the number one drug dealer for White Thing, and White Thing saw him getting powerful. So White Thing sent agents to destroy him, and instead they got his wife, who was pregnant with a child. And his revenge is based on that. You hurt not just me. You meant to get me, but you hurt the thing that was closest to me. He humanized Ahab. You know, Ahab in the novel has a wife and a son.
Now, I imagine these are young people. Remix culture is part of their world, part of their life. So they're probably really comfortable with this approach. But there must have been older people in the prison system or people who came and watched the play who wouldn't be so comfortable with remixing a classic.
Well, in the beginning, I got quite a bit of resistance from the established community, if you will. Not the academic community, though, which I was surprised. This project was followed very closely by the New Media Literacies Program at MIT and the conference that we planned around our production of Moby Dick with their assistance. We brought in scholars from all over the country, and they were the ones who were the most supportive of saying, this is a great novel. We've got to find a way to get young people invested in this great novel. And this is a way of doing it. You know, in remixing, and this is one of the things I talk about a lot when I talk about not just remixing and appropriation and Moby Dick and Frankenstein and on and on and on. You have to trust the original text. You have to respect the original text. And you have to understand the source of where you're getting things from. And then when you remix, you don't change the original. What you do is find a way for you to access the original.
So when you do something like this, what's the difference between ripping off Melville and remixing Melville?
When you talk about ripping off Melville, what a term. First of all, you should rip off Melville and Shakespeare and Ibsen and Shaw and Baldwin and all of them. They should be ripped off. You should go and grab what they've got to offer and take it and run with it and learn from it. But in the process, if literature is good, there's almost nothing you can do to destroy it. When we're in a process of remixing or doing an adaptation, page-to-stage adaptation, I tell myself and the people I'm working with, we're going to test this thing to the breaking point. We're going to find every way we can for this thing to fall apart. Because when you start to layer remixing and appropriation over it, if the original material is good and solid, it keeps giving no matter how much stress you put on it. And drama demands that you push it to the limit. Push it until it breaks. Well, you know, Melville never broke. No matter what layer we put on top of it, Melville just kept giving.
Ricardo Pitts Wiley is the writer and director of the theatrical production of Moby Dick, Then and Now, a production from Rhode Island's State Juvenile Correction Facility. You can hear conversations with all the writers in today's episode. You'll find them on our website at ttbook.org, along with the complete TT Book Difficult Summer Beach Reading List, which also, by the way, includes our staff's personal recommendations. And so, dear reader, get thee to a library.